going to call this meeting of the House Early Childhood and Family Supports Committee to order for Thursday, April 13th, 2017. Committee members, we're going to change the order a little bit here from what is shown on your calendar. So we'll be starting first with the informational meeting, and then after that. So at this point, there won't be work sessions on 3314 or 3367. After we've completed the informational meeting, we'll have the public hearing on House Bill 2985. Then we will, after that, we'll have a work session on House Bill 3087 for the purposes of reviewing another amendment and to see if there's other questions people have that might have come up since the last session. And then on House Bill 3068, we'll be carrying that over with the rest of them until next Tuesday. Okay? Have I confused you enough on that that I can just go ahead? No?
Oh.
Okay.
Yep. I took notes.
Thank you. So I'm going to open the informational hearing on Reach Out and Read. And I see four people. If you want to all come up with the...
Two at a time.
Two at a time? Okay. Whatever the order is. Who's up first? Just introduce yourself for the record. It is more comfortable two at a time, but you know.
Yeah.
Okay, because they don't have to sit next to each other.
That's right.
Oh, you're so far away. Chair Lively, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Maria Sleeman. I am the program director of Reach Out and Read in Oregon. I would first like to thank you for your past state investment in Reach Out and Read. This has been critical in ensuring children in Oregon are prepared and ready for kindergarten. Reach Out and Read Oregon is an evidence-based program promoting early literacy through primary care beginning in infancy. We partner with primary care providers who volunteer their time to prescribe books and educate families about the importance of establishing early literacy skills. Parents receive guidance from on the importance of reading aloud daily, and children are given a book at every well-child visit. By the time a child turns five, they have a small library made possible by Reach Out and Read. Currently, we serve approximately 75,000 children in Oregon and 112,000 parents and caregivers. This is through about 150,000 well-child visits every single year. With a $100,000 investment in the state, from the state, we would be able to continue to serve these children and families. We have about 121 program sites, and we utilize approximately 1,200 volunteer medical providers and staff. The state of investment would also help us add the additional goal of increasing the children served in the state by about 5% each year. Reach Out and Read was available in Oregon for 11 years without a local coalition. During that time, they added about 3 sites per year for a total of 33 sites. And about 5 years ago, we formed a statewide coalition and have added about 17 sites per year on average. This is about a 267% increase, which is far above the national average, which tends to be about 5% per year. So this shows the need, especially in Oregon, for a local coalition. We can talk about Reach Out and Read all day, but we thought it would be easiest to show you a quick video on how the program actually works. And after that, you'll hear from a clinic administrator and some providers on the importance and need for Reach Out and Read.
Great. Thank you.
And do you have this one?
No.
What do you think this book's about?
The cookie.
About cookies. How did you know that? So let's see if you can find all the letters in your name right here.
Okay. Y-O-U-C-E-F.
Oh, you're so clever. All right. Okay, and are you good at colors too?
Yeah.
Okay. Let's see
but
if we can.
I always scribble a little bit outside and too much scribble outside.
Oh, you're scribbly? Okay.
Yeah.
How about some colors? Do you know some colors like this?
I only like red because red are fire.
Fire. Okay. Would you like any of the other colors?
I like purple and green, and I like all of them.
Yeah. Do you ever read books at home?
I don't know how to read.
I know, but you're awfully close to it because you know all your letters.
Yeah.
Yeah. What kind of books does
all
he like?
Kind.
And does he have any favorite books? That the fire engine book?
Does it have stories? That's his favorite. Yeah. Okay. Stories. Like, what do they do with the fire engine? Okay. What does it do?
So Yusuf, do you read books when you're eating lunch?
I read big books.
Do you? Great big books?
Yeah.
What, tell me the name of one of the books that you read.
I will read small ones because
you're such a big boy.
Because they're so tiny and they're not big.
So what I want you to do is I want you to tell me a story about this picture. Tell me a story about this picture.
He make a lot of mess.
He did. Do you ever make a mess?
Sometimes I do.
And so what are we doing over here? That's sort of a hard picture, but what's he doing in there? What's the boy doing?
He's trying to clean up.
That's right. Okay, after the mess-making mouse.
And he was reading a book.
There. Do you think mice read?
No.
No, they don't. So yeah, you are such a clever guy. So I'm very happy about how he's doing, how he's ready for school, and it looks like he gets a lot of enjoyment out of all the right things. And would you like to look at the cookie book? Or would you like to look at the bear book? Or
the cookie book.
All right, the cookie book there. I thought that might be one of your favorites. So you don't have that book at home? You want to take it home with you?
Thank you.
You're welcome.
I'll read it, and I'll put with the big books.
You're gonna. Is this a big enough book?
You need numbers on it.
Okay. Is this a big enough book for you?
No, we're gonna go
number. I like it.
I do too.
Nice. Very cute.
Good afternoon, Chair Lively, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Prashanthi Kavetti, and I am a clinic administrator at Willamette Family Medical Center here in Salem. We are one of the largest private nonprofit primary care clinics in town. We've been offering quality services to the members of our low-income community here in Marion, Polk, and some of Yamhill County. We've been offering services for over 21 years and participating in the Reach Out and Read program for almost 11 now. Our patient population is very low income, and this program has been very well received between our providers and our patients. Most of the patients that come into our clinic have told our providers and our staff that they cannot afford any books, and by the time that their child is 6 months old, they don't have any home library to read to their kids. So this is a great opportunity for our providers to really look at and engage patients in early literacy and academic success. With the help of the Reach Out and Read Coalition and the Marion County Early Learning Hub, we're able to provide books to our kids. By the time they graduate from the program, they're able to have at least 10 books in their home library. This program has been so well received amongst our small 6 month to 5 year patients that we've expanded the program to participate and use the tenets of Reach Out and Read with our prenatal patients to help teach moms about the importance of early literacy very early on. We're able to give gently used books to the siblings of these patients so that they can go home with a book too, to really expand that library and expand that idea of reading together and learning together. At this point, we've also been giving all of our books are bilingual. So we've learned that it's important for kids to learn in their first language, so it really gives an opportunity to promote that family togetherness. Thank you.
That's great.
Any members have any questions at this point? Great. That video was great. Thank you.
That's great.
Okay. Good afternoon, Chair Lively and members of the committee. My name is Allison Empey, and I'm a Confederated Tribes of Grand Ronde tribal member, and I'm also currently a pediatrician at Oregon Health and Science University. As a resident, I participate in Reach Out and Read. I saw how excited the kids got when we walked in their room and handed them their book. I love listening to the parents tell me how they incorporated reading aloud at bedtime with their families. And I knew the literature. Reading aloud works. I love being part of Reach Out and Read at OHSU, but I wanted to bring this back to my tribe. I wanted my tribal youth to have better vocabulary, be more kindergarten ready, and score higher on their third grade reading scores, because we know this predicts high school dropout rates. And so I approached the tribal clinic as well as the tribal council, and together we were able to bring Reach Out and Read to our tribal youth. I'm proud to say the program has been at the tribe for over 3 years now. As primary care physicians, we have the unique opportunity to see children during their first 1,000 days. These first 1,000 days are critical for brain development. By 1 year of life, the brain's processing speed already significantly differs based on parent-child interaction. By age 2 years, a word gap between higher and lower income children already exists. By age 3, low-income children have heard 30 million fewer words cumulatively than children in higher income households. Reading aloud is the single best activity to increase language exposure, and this should be started in infancy. It's too late to start in kindergarten. Even in communities with home visits, fewer than 2 to 10% are regularly visited. During the first years of life alone, a family will go to their pediatrician or their child's healthcare provider 5 to 6 times for well baby visits. And 95% of children see a primary care physician provider in their first 2 years of life. I've seen the potential impact of Reach Out and Read in my community, and I'd love to see more children in our state benefit and get off to the right start. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Please. Chair Lively and members of the committee, my name is Dr. Ellen Stevenson, and I serve as the medical director for Reach Out and Read Oregon. I'm a pediatrician at Dornbecker and in Northeast Portland at Children's Community Clinic, which is a member of the Coalition of Community Clinics. I'm also an associate professor at Oregon Health and Science University, where I study early brain and child development. The experience of healthcare providers that you've just heard from are supported by substantial research. Reading aloud strengthens parent-child interactions and builds the language literacy and social-emotional skills that you've heard last throughout a lifetime. The American Academy of Pediatrics formally recommends literacy promotion to be an essential component of pediatric care beginning at birth, highlighting Reach Out and Read as an effective intervention. As you've heard from many low-income families, a well child visit is the only consistent contact with either the health or education systems for the years before a child enters preschool or kindergarten, when brain development is rapidly progressing. 15 independent published studies prove Reach Out and Read's efficacy. We know that children served by Reach Out and Read have a 3 to 6 month language development. They're 3 to 6 months ahead of their peers, starting kindergarten with better language skills and stronger vocabularies, but also better social-emotional skills. They're ready to sit still when they have reading time and other activities in the classroom. Parents served by the program are 4 times more likely to read aloud regularly with children, and that's up to 10 times in families where English is not the primary language at home. We know that many children in Oregon, over 1 in 5, live in poverty, and in children in poverty, over 50% are not kindergarten ready. Many states, including our neighbors in Washington, as well as states like Georgia and South Carolina, invest more and in significantly higher levels than Oregon in programs like Reach Out and Read to promote early literacy. While it's a public private partnership, the FQHCs and smaller clinics can't do this without your support. I respectfully request that your committee support the state's investment in this valuable program. With that support, we can spark a lifelong love of reading during the most critical window of brain development, increase school readiness, and open the doors of opportunity for more of Oregon's children. Thank you so much for your time and attention to our state's earliest learners.
Representative Peluso.
Thank you, Chair Lively. This is all really great, great stuff, but I'm sort of embarrassed to say I had never heard of the Reach Out and Read, perhaps because my only child's 24 now. So can you give me a little background or a history of the program?
Absolutely. So the program actually began in Boston about 25 years ago, and it began organically. You know, people brought in their children's books, and they saw that they were leaving the waiting room, and they thought, well, you know, this is Boston City. It's an urban environment. Kids must need books if they're going home, so they kept bringing more. And being an academic center, they, over the years, have studied and incorporated it. And, you know, we've learned so much in recent years, and really in the very recent years, about the things Dr. Empey talked about the processing speed. We now even have, like, MRIs that show that children, by the time they're 3 or 5, it lights up in different parts of your brain. The architecture is different if you've been read to. So they, as a program, really started incorporating all that research and becoming a more academic program and emphasizing working, you know, at this, you know, state and federal level and training students and residents. And that's how I got involved. I was actually asked by, some of you may know David Willis, because he used to be very involved in the state. And he came to me before he left to, you know, work on the home visiting programs in Washington and said, will you work on this program here? You know, I'm going to be nationally, but we really need to do this. And so I took on his challenge and have an extra full-time job. You know, we were talking on the way down. It's hard not to volunteer to do this when you see the power. I don't know if that answers your question.
That's very helpful. Thank you. And thanks for the work. That's great.
Yes. Welcome.
Representative Kinnegar.
I'm texting David a picture of you right now. He's still on it.
Thank you.
Representative Malmstrom.
Thank you for your presentation today. I just wanted to say to the rest of my committee that this is a wonderful program. I've spent my whole career working in this field, and we've had at the FQHCs, you know, at Multnomah County Health Department, we've had them, and I have seen firsthand over all the time you've done it, the wonderful benefits of kids. You know, they become less restless. When I've gone out in home visits and follow-ups, you know, I see those same books at home and how they talk about them. And even with the littlest children, just those little kids getting the understanding of, you know, turning the page and anticipating that and coaching moms how to incorporate that into routines, it's a wonderful thing. And so there are families that this is the only books they have in their home. And sometimes you can, they once they see how well they're incorporated, then they start to buy books on their own because they begin to see the value of them. So thank you very much for the program.
Thank you so much for those additional comments. And I will add, they've done some research, and in fact, it's true that those books do multiply. So children who get the 10 books, the library doesn't stay at 10 books, because if you're read to in the first year of your life, those children bring the books to their, you know, parent or caregiver and sort of demand to be read to. And so then they go out and look for more. So it's very true. Yes.
I think one of the most rewarding things in working with this is what we've learned over the years, and again, the value of things that in some cases seem fairly simple, but they have great value. Because when I first got involved in early childhood learning was many years ago, and it was around abuse. But one of the things we did was work, so what techniques can we give to parents and things to deal with, and especially poor parents in that? And reading was one. In those days, we didn't think about the value that you're describing here today, that we've learned so much about it, but just that was something they could do if they had a book, that they could do with their children in order to help. But now we know that there was a lot of other benefits besides just doing that. So it's pretty fascinating. Great work.
Yeah, it is. It is sort of amazing as the science has sort of caught up and all the focus on that serve and return early attachment.
That's right.
So it's really interesting. Yeah. Thank you so much.
Yeah.
Questions? Any questions?
Great. Thanks. Thank you so much. Thanks for
thank
the presentation.
You.
Sure. So I'm going to close the informational hearing. And so next we're going to do House Bill 2985. So I'll open a public hearing on House Bill 2985. So Zena, do you want to?
Chair Lively, members of the committee, House Bill 2985 modifies the employment-related child care subsidy program under the Department of Human Services. There is a -1 amendment that replaces the measure. It creates a 20-member task force on employment-related child care to conduct a study of employment-related daycare access and availability of subsidies and to develop a plan to expand access. It sunsets January 2nd, 2020 and declares an emergency effective on passage. Do not have the fiscal and revenue impact statements.
Okay. So we have Kate, James, and Arissa. Elris. Okay. Yeah, that's. I don't even try to do writing anymore. So. Welcome.
Thank you. Chair Lively, members of the committee, my name is Kate Newhall, and I'm here today testifying on behalf of Family Forward Oregon. Thank you for the opportunity to testify generally on the employment-related daycare program and specifically on the Dash 1 amendments. We believe that it's time to take a comprehensive look at our employment-related daycare program, which we think is very successful for the very lucky but very few families who are actually able to enroll in it. Unfortunately, it's also a dramatically underfunded program, and we're currently only able to serve about 8,000 families out of the estimated 40,000 families that are eligible for it. The Dash 1 amendments, as you heard, will remove entirely the existing contents of House Bill 2985 and replace it with a task force to look at growing our ERDC program to serve all of the families who are currently eligible and eventually to grow the program beyond the current 185% of federal poverty level income limit. We think it's time to take a comprehensive approach to improving our whole child care system and growing our subsidy program to truly meet the needs of all low and middle income families. As you know, access to high quality and affordable childcare is one of the greatest challenges facing Oregon working parents and their children today. It's a problem that low and middle income families across Oregon struggle with. It's expensive and it's putting strain on families. And yet our childcare providers, many of whom are parents themselves, are underpaid. The work that childcare providers do is critical to many positive long-term impacts for kids, and it's also the work that makes all other work possible. But we are not compensating our childcare workers in accordance with the tremendous value of their work. We know that ensuring parents have access to high-quality childcare for their child is essential to making sure that those parents can remain in the workforce and maintain their economic security. It's also essential to a child's long-term educational and economic success. There is a wealth of research demonstrating the benefits of childcare and other early education programs, not only for the development outcomes of the children, but also for the economic stability of their parents. Without childcare options, parents, predominantly mothers, are often forced out of the workplace to care full-time for children. This compromises the worker's ability to earn an income, but also a work history and save for their future. On an individual level, affordable childcare enables parents to maintain economic security and mitigates career disruptions and long periods of unemployment. For many Oregonians, the cost of childcare compared to income is so prohibitively high that it can push a primary breadwinner out of the workforce. When wages do little more than replace the cost of care, it can often lead to financial ruin and instability for the family. We think that the crisis we face around childcare is an example of a market failure, and one that our state government should be working to address. When the cost of care exceeds what most parents can afford, and yet the people providing it are some of the lowest paid workers in our state, the only way to bridge this gap is to direct more public spending to support comprehensive child care programs. Our state investments in child care should reasonably accomplish three goals. They should support good long-term outcomes for our kids, they should support working parents who require child care to maintain a job, and they should help ensure that the people doing this work earn a decent and living wage. Unlike most other approaches to childcare, increasing our investment in employment-related daycare can accomplish these three goals. It contemplates the quality of the care that kids receive, the wages providers are paid, and a wide age range when childcare is needed. We know that growing our childcare subsidy program will take more than just allocating resources. It's going to take a thoughtful approach and careful planning. It won't just happen overnight. We need to look at growing, as we look to growing the program, we also need to ensure that we have sufficient providers to meet an increased demand, and we're actually able to do outreach to parents to educate them about the program and that it exists. Currently, we're not able to do any outreach because the program is so budget strapped as it is. We know that expanding access to ERDC will take a system-wide approach and probably will include a phased approach so that we can make sure that we are growing the providers that we need to meet the increased demand as we do it. The task force that proposed will examine our child care system and make recommendations for this phased approach. We also believe, yes, it's a large task force, but it's important to include all of the players in the child care system, from providers, advocates, parents, the statewide hubs and the agencies that administer the ERDC program. So we think that House Bill 2985 and the Dash 1 amendments will be...
Well, I was just asking if you were going to let James talk.
Is James making faces at me?
Just kidding.
No, so with that, I'll let James talk.
Sorry, Kate.
Okay.
Thank you, Chair Lively, members of the committee. My name is James Barta. I'm the Legislative Director for Children First for Oregon, and I am following up on Kate's introduction for the need for examining this program. Employment-related daycare is something that addresses one of the biggest needs that we're looking at in the country. You know, it's been the subject of the presidential debates. It's been something that I think everyone on the committee knows about, because everyone know, you know, if they don't have children themselves, of course they know people with children, and they know the costs and expenses they face. And so, you know, simply put, right now, for our families, it's unaffordable. You know, in a previous presentation, this committee talked about how in many places it's more expensive than housing, even. It's more expensive than college tuition. And part of that reason is we fund for our children in this state, and as we should. We fund our K-12 education system. We fund post-secondary education. We need to do those things, and we need to do them better, frankly. But for the dollar that we spend on those other systems, we only put pennies on the dollar in our early childhood system. And so probably the best program we have is the employment-related daycare. Unfortunately, as Kate was already outlining, it doesn't meet the needs that most of the eligible families have. In fact, the federal recommended guidelines is that people shouldn't spend more than 10% of their income on child care, and let alone the tens of thousands of families who are eligible who aren't getting ERDC because they don't know about it or whatever the reason is. But even for those people on ERDC, if they make, you know, just a rather modest amount of money, the copays are above 10%. And we see in rural areas, as some people have pointed out to us, how the subsidies that go to many of the providers don't meet their demands as well. And so this is an issue that needs further studies, simply put. So we need a system that ERDC does well, that helps bring quality providers in, that helps make the program more affordable, and, of course, helps children have safe, quality care so they can grow up in a nurturing environment. And so I think everyone agrees that this is a popular program. When I worked on this with many of the people up here and many of you 2 years ago to expand ERDC, I've got, you know, more than 25 organizations that supported it. It includes nonprofits like ourselves, includes business organizations, unions, all sorts of different people recognize the need for child care. And so I think it's time to get it right, and that's why we need this task force.
Thank you.
All right. Chair Lively, members of the committee, my name is Elvis Argueta. People call me Elvis. I'm a political organizer for SEIU 503. We represent child care providers known as regulated subsidy providers, or what used to be known as family, friends, and neighbors providers in the employment-related daycare program. I'm here in support of House Bill 2985-1 amendment, which will help expand and improve employment-related daycare, a program that helps low-income working families pay for child care at a time when Oregon ranks at the bottom of child care affordability, which I'll let you know, it's really unaffordable. It's like $1,500 just for myself, for my child, which is more than rent in some areas. So, like, I recognize that it's unaffordable. ERDC supports Oregon families by making sure that child care is not a barrier on the path to stable employment. Oregon is currently serving about 11% of eligible families in the ERDC program over the last 5 years. The program is vital to families accessing ERDC and can be a turning point in achieving self-sufficiency to those who might otherwise not have that opportunity. The program has seen some changes in the last year, and as a result of the child care reauthorization of the Child Care Development Block Grant, which added new regulations to providers. These changes highlight the need to study the impact to families and providers in the program, which we hope to achieve with a task force. These new regulations have added some complexity to how families and providers enter the system and how they progress through the program successfully. We want to ensure that families have the support they need and that providers have the technical assistance needed to have children be prepared for their next developmental step. One way we can help this is by allocating substantial investments to pay for providers, a chronically low-paid workforce. Child care providers are considerably underpaid compared to workers in other professions with similar levels of training and experience. As a result of the low pay, there is constant turnover in the workforce that has an adverse effect on the children in their care. This is a good opportunity for the legislature to make ERDC stronger, but in order to do that, we must also raise revenue in order to build a system that sets a high bar for services for children. This is not a time for Oregon's children to take a brunt of the storm. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions? Representative Hayden.
Thank you, Chair Lively. Thank you for the testimony. Supportive of figuring out what's wrong with the system, but reluctant to, everybody needs more money. We get it. I mean, that's the answer. Well, we'll cover more cases if we have more money. But the system that I supported last time came through, once it got through the setup, through the system, provides approximately 50% more dollars if you live in a urban area based purely on the concept that wages are market rate is what they call it, based purely on market rate. So the wealthy stay wealthier and the rural poor stay poor. I think it's unfortunate because we are trying to raise people out of poverty, including child care workers, that if you base it strictly on here's what the market rate is in your area, and you are in a significantly economically depressed place, the market rate is not a good standard to base that on. You should be including something that actually helps these employees work with the families to where it raises them up out of poverty also. On an equitable basis that you have in urban areas. And then the urban areas have more ability to get the highest level of certificate. And these are all based on three different zip codes across the state. Supposedly on economic wherewithal from those zip codes. We based minimum wage on zip codes based on the same economy as a scale. Strangely enough, those are not the same zip codes because they cite different studies. Why wouldn't those be the same zip codes if it really is economy that's driving it? If it really was economy that drove the three different minimum wages. So I question the approach of using these market rate studies because it keeps low-income daycare providers in economically depressed areas at low wages. It does not help lift them out of the poverty, and it does not provide the higher quality of daycare for them to be able to do that. So I'm supportive of fixing with the money that we have. Just to add more money to that system, yes, but fix the problem first. Thank you.
Chair Lively, Representative Hayden. Wasn't a question quite
it,
in there,
it was a comment with many questions built in. Go ahead and respond.
I want to say that I think you will find on the next panel someone who is in great agreement with you on this, and I'll just add that it is based on a survey, And you know, and the person who conducts the survey, Dr. Bobby Weber, has spoken to this committee several times. And so I don't really want to speak for her at all.
Sure.
But you know, you have the opportunity to talk to her on the on this survey, and I don't claim to know all the details, but I think that is one of the problems that needs to be addressed, because we you know, we have this you know a great expert in, here in the state on it, yet there's something missing for some of the providers. We have this high reimbursement subsidy rate, yet we're still having trouble getting providers. So you know, I agree with you.
Thank you.
And can I just one more thing? I think I agree with you on the rate. One of the things that's deeply in the 350-page child care development grant is it does give the option for the state to look at other methodologies to come to a rate. It doesn't just tie us to the market rate. And I would think, I would hope that that's one of the, that is one of the focuses, not I think, it's one of the focuses of the task force to try to help study that a little bit more. Because right now, that market rate, it's what we have right now. But we also need to look a little deeper into it and find other methodologies. There are other states that use other methodologies to get to that rate.
Well, thank you. Just thank you for the response. Again, my concern with market rate is it keeps people where they're at, because it's basing it on the poverty that they're in. We want to lift them out of poverty.
And if I may, I'll just, Chair Lively, Representative Hayden, add one piece onto that. I agree with you completely, and that's part of why we want to look at this in the task force. I would also say one of the things that also happens, I think, it both in urban but a lot in rural communities, is we have sometimes what are called child care deserts, where we really don't even have the number of providers that we need to meet the need. So I think that's one of the things that I would also like this task force to be looking at, is how do we, in those child care desert areas, better incentivize to providers to get the number of providers that we need. And I think that that might dovetail into kind of what you're raising too, which is if they're making low rates, they sort of get stuck down into low rates, and so why would anybody want to come in and do it?
So can I get to my question now?
Okay.
I do have a question. All right. Thank you. Yes. Thank you for the latitude here. It's a very important issue to me. Is it possible for you to go out and bring us solutions and then have a ask for dollars in the short session or something, but bring us something back with this task force without a $50 million attachment to it, but bring us something back to, we are going to do X in this task force, and then in the short session, if there needs to be some balancing, would that even be a consideration, or is it all about the dollars?
Well, Chair Lively, Representative Hayden, it's not just about the dollars. And I think when we were looking at this task force, we sort of thought about when is the appropriate times for them to be coming back and reporting back. And we felt like that to be bringing a report back for the short session was probably not sufficient time for this task force to do the look that they needed to do. So we specifically timed the report back on the task force to be coming back in time to be making recommendations to the 2019 legislature. And I think it is both about, I recognize that resources are tight and short, but I'm not going to deny that I think that the employment-related daycare program needs more resources to be able to serve more families. But I also do want to be able to look at the program, like you're suggesting, and say, is this a smart way to grow the program? Is this a strategic way to grow the program? And how do we most effectively sort of roll that out? Because I think even if we had infinite dollars to throw at this program, you wouldn't be able to just turn on a faucet and ramp it up overnight. So I want to be smart with the dollars that we do have and that we're looking to invest further in employment-related daycare.
Okay. Well, I want to be very supportive, but I also want to know that we will not just be putting more dollars into a system without knowing that it is as effective as possible and raising people out of poverty at the same time.
I agree.
Representative Kindergarten.
Thank you. And I want to just clarify that you're taking a bill that was originally a request for increase in ERDC and turning it into a task force to look at all these kind of issues, right? So I hope that you'll support, because I think the charge is to look at this kind of stuff. And I just want to say on that question, I know you brought it up before, And on one hand, you know, looking at costs is fair because the minimum wage in our urban area, the rents are higher. How do you break even? And on the other hand, to support your point, I agree that we need to be very intentional both about the desert situation of not having enough providers. And I think of that as being very much like the incentives that we give rural healthcare providers, where even in the rural areas where their expenses may be lower, we're actually trying to incentivize people to go to those areas because we know there's lack of access, and thus we give them a greater break on their loans than we do often the urban. Part of that's because they might be able to make more in an urban area, but I think that those are very valid points. I just think that all of these things should be considered: costs, expenses, revenue that they might be able to gain, lack of revenue in certain rural areas where people just don't have extra money, how we can supplement that to be very targeted to achieve our goals. So this meant to be in support of what you just said, but also to urge you to support the bill because it's a task force. It's not the increase in funding that we originally sought.
Okay. I'm reading the dash one as we speak.
Any other questions, Representative Huffman?
Not a question.
Okay,
No. Just a comment. I think we should also run a parallel task force, and I'm only being partly facetious. I know you guys generally think I'm totally facetious, but to look at why child care costs, what the legislature has done over the last three or four biennia that has gotten families in the situation they are. I used to be on Human Services. I've been, we've passed lots and lots and lots of bills, mandates, regulations around child care. And I can't help but wonder, is it any wonder? And we've done it for good reasons. Child safety, you name it, education. But that stuff comes at a cost. And now we're back here going, but we need more money to help our families. And I agree, but there's an nexus.
So, Chair?
There is.
I would love to get a report back on that because my impression is not that we've added a lot of regulation in the child care arena. And I've been a part of these discussions, so it would be good to perhaps have the child care division come back to us and report what are the added regulations that we have in place that may have driven up costs versus what are the child care tax credits, because I think that we've actually alleviated overall. My impression is that we've alleviated the burden somewhat. It's just that we have limited dollars. But I think the child care tax credit work that we did last year, 2 years ago, has helped many more families than it had before. But I think it was, we have different memories. So I think it would be really important to have a report back on that.
I did say, two or three biennia, but I think, I don't know when it was, but what we really need to go back to is when we started limiting the number of kids that a
family daycare
grandma or somebody could watch at one time. I mean, that's when we started.
That
the ball
may have been a
on.
Long time ago, but that would
yeah,
be
was,
good to track.
So it's been a progression. Uh-huh. So it has been more than 6 or 8 years.
Elvis.
So just a point is that there have been some new regulations since the reauthorization of the 2015 CCDBG, and all of those have been rolled out. And once, if you take one, it's not so much a big deal. Mm-hmm. Once you start adding them, it becomes a little bit of a barrier with unintended consequences. With good intentions, there have been things that have come along.
Can you say what some of those are?
So, for instance, in the current climate that we're in, there are now a requirement of a certain minimum of house visits inspections to some of the providers that hadn't been there before. Mm-hmm. And so when you think about families who are afraid of, for their family member or what have you, that they live with, having someone coming from the state to come inspect their home, that's just one example. Mm-hmm. There have been added trainings that are mandated to providers that hadn't been mandated before. And as we've just spoke to about earlier, particularly my members, they get paid anywhere between $15 to $364 per child, and then you add trainings that, if they are in certain instances pre-service, they don't get paid to go do those trainings. And so you add this, there's all these different apps, and this is why the task force could look at it. I think there are ways mm-hmm. to be able to become compliant with the federal regulations but still achieve the goals of the program.
Sure.
So I just want to clarify one thing my good colleague here beside me said. On the amendment, it is not a gut and stuff, and the amendment takes out lines 2 through 27, leaving lines 29 through 41. And so that was my question. Is this only a task force, or is it a task force stuffed into a financial request? And somebody... anybody in the room, all of which are smarter than me, can you verify that you are not taking out lines 29 through, or probably actually 30, because that's where B starts, I think, if I get back to it here quick enough, B, 29 through 41 that has the Section 3, which is the funding request, correct? I mean, so you have a funding request of blank amount of dollars in addition to the task force, right? Is that correct?
Chair Lively, Representative Hayden, the intent of this amendment is that it is a gut and stuff. And I think it's deleting all of lines 5 through 27 on page 1 and then deleting all of page 2.
Okay, keep going. I thought it was lines 2 through 27 of page 2. No?
No, it's all of page 2.
It's all of page 2.
I told you you're all smarter than me.
My chair was.
All right. Okay. Thank you very much. Representative Hayden, I would just say you brought up a similar issue earlier when some of the other programs we're talking about, the what happens in rural versus urban. And I think once we get through the 18th, we'll talk a little bit more about then other things we can do potentially between now and the short session, because those were valid questions then, again, about how we apply programs and it works. So,
yeah. All right.
Okay, so next we have Janet, Tori, and Eva. I saw Eva was coming up here, shooting up here.
I'm ready to answer questions about market rate study, so I'll get to that.
Good afternoon, Chair Lively and members of the committee. My name is Janet Bauer. I'm a policy analyst with the Oregon Center for Public Policy. We are a research organization with a mission to advance policies and practices that improve economic opportunities for all Oregonians. We are in support of House Bill 2985-1, and I'm here to briefly talk about the research on the impacts of public investments in quality child care. I'll briefly share about the impacts on children, parents, and providers. When a child has access to high-quality early child care, it increases his or her chances of success as an adult. Quality early learning programs have been shown to support a child's emotional and social growth, as well as their cognitive development. These positive impacts have lifelong benefits. Specifically, quality early child care has been shown to boost a child's subsequent economic performance, educational attainment, job prospects, and lifetime earnings. Quality care also improves lifetime health outcomes. The research also shows benefits of quality early child care for parents. Affordable quality child care enables parents to maintain economic stability, return to the workforce earlier, and remain there longer. Parents with access to financial assistance for quality care have fewer missed days of work and greater job retention. Access to quality care also helps parents further their own education and training, which can translate into higher earnings. Public investments in child care also benefit providers and improve the quality of their care. Research has found that subsidies are associated with lower levels of economic distress and depression amongst the otherwise low-wage workforce. Quality care is not a challenge just for low-income families. It's a problem for middle-income households as well. clearly a plan for substantially investing in child care is needed. There are about 146,000 children currently eligible for Oregon's ERDC program. Over the last 5 years, we have served an average of only 11% of them. If Oregon were to extend assistance to middle-income households, we would need to plan to cover about twice as many children as are eligible for ERDC today. So I want to thank you for your thoughtful consideration and support of House Bill 2985-1. Thank you.
Thank you.
Next. Chair Lively, members of the committee, my name is Tori Fitchett, and I am here in support of House Bill 2985-1. I am here to provide a real-world anecdotal example of how important child care can be. My twin daughters have been disrupting your committee meeting. Apologies for that.
No, they weren't. That's okay. Thank you.
Not at all.
And so they were born 2.5 years ago, and my wife and I did not know that we were having twins. So whatever calculations we may have made all went out the window. There were lots of testimony about the expense and relative unavailability of childcare. With twins, all of that is at least twice as difficult. When they were born, my wife and I were both fully employed and were hoping to maintain about that same amount of employment with her job giving her some time off. When the twins showed up and whatever conglomerate of family assistance that we were hoping to get was no longer a feasible option. After about a year, we made the decision that it was actually best for me to leave the workforce to be with our daughters full time so that she could work more. I had been planning on going back to school, so it wasn't a huge transition, but that whole decision has given me at least 2 years out of the workforce with at least another year of school before I'm probably fully employed again. And we fall right in that spot where we make just enough money to not qualify for most social services, but we don't have enough money to adequately provide for our children's future. They don't have any college savings or anything like that yet because of the position that not having childcare put us in led to that decision. So I'm just here to encourage you to do anything you can to explore the options and increase the funding, because it makes a real difference for everyday people who otherwise would be, you know, adding to all those positive statistics that we want to see about our economy. So thank you.
Thank you, Tori.
Chair Lively, Vice Chair Tack and Peluso, members of the committee, I'm Eva Ripito with Oregon AFSCME Council 75. We represent licensed in-home child care providers, a few Head Starts in the state, and families who also qualify for employment-related daycare. Some of our members are at or below 185% of federal poverty, which makes them qualified. As you've heard from our partners, I'm part of the group that helped come up with 2985-1. We're working on trying to figure out ways to expand and better support providers and families that to get better access to affordable, quality child care that meets family and children's needs. Employment-related daycare is a uniquely empowering program allowing parents to choose and afford the best child care suited for their child, their work situation, and their family's unique needs. This is reflected in the fact that ERDC can be used for child care provided to children aged 6 weeks through 12 years old. I kind of want to take a pause here for a second. Child care are not allowed to take care of children under the age of 6 weeks old, and many providers don't take children under 12 weeks of age if they take infants at all. That's a side note for another bill that's in front of you. Ensuring parents can access early childhood care, preschool, and also summer and after school care needed by school age kids. Additionally, a range of child care providers can enroll in ERDC, including centers, in-home-based settings, or friends, family, and neighbors of an eligible family. These choices are essential to ensuring true access to a wide range of families and also to ensuring care that is designed to meet the cultural, language, geographic, and other needs of many unique families throughout our state. Families that are lucky enough to find out about and get enrolled in the subsidy program are more easily able to find child care that meets their and their child's needs. And we should be looking to grow and expand this program. And it's not just as simple as dedicating more resources to fund current eligibility and increasing income eligibility. To truly grow this program to serve all eligible families and expand income eligibility, we'll need to take a thoughtful and multifaceted approach. We need to make sure that we that we're focusing on recruiting and retaining providers and serve eligible and newly eligible families. To put time and thought into this, we to improve access and eligibility, we are proposing a task force with a broad base of early learning and child care experts and others familiar with the program. We've included child care providers and Head Start to provide input from the provider community. We've included three early learning hubs to get regional perspectives on what may be needed for building a more cohesive program for providers and families. And we included people with expertise in social justice and cultural competency, because too often the programs we build or strive to improve only perpetuate barriers that have been created by systemic racism and discrimination. We've also asked for representation of three parents who use the program. This may prove to be a challenge, but we know that there are parent councils through hubs, and that we hope we can find some parents that will be willing and able to participate. We are actually asking the task force to provide two reports to get to one of Representative Hayden's questions earlier. The first on how we cover all families who currently are eligible for ERDC, and how to rebuild the provider community that will be due in January of 2018. And then the second, covering expansion of the program beyond current eligibility and long-term benefits to children, families, and providers, of expanding access and availability to child care subsidies, and the timeline for this expansion due to the legislature in January 2019. And of course, the language in the bill does not limit it to those things. It can be expanded, and I would love to have a conversation about the market rate study. As Janet and others have pointed out, we are serving less than 16% of the families that are eligible. This, we know, is due to the on and off again nature of the reservation list, or also known as inconsistency and inavailability, as well as difficulty for many to find child care that meets their needs. The two reports will allow for an in-depth look at the issues that we face in providing a child care subsidy program that is stable and consistent. And because of the tight timeline for delivering the first report, we are asking for the emergency clause. This will give us time, get us on the ground and running, getting appointed people, and then a quick turnaround for that first report due in January. To continue to improve our child care workforce and provide affordable and accessible child care for Oregonians, we need to take a deliberative look at how to do this best. This task force and the reports they will produce will provide us with clear recommendations on how to best do this. I welcome any questions that you have.
Thank you very much. Any questions, further questions? Doesn't look like it. Thank you very much for the work on this.
May I give a comment about the market rate study too? I just thought about that before I closed.
You're going to stir something up?
Potentially.
Go ahead.
I love that you are tenaciously asking questions about the market rate study. I've heard you bring it up several times. One of the things that I know from working with our providers is that there's sometimes some confusion about what they can and cannot ask of their parents. It is clear in the rules that they can always ask private pay parents more for a higher rate than the subsidy parents, but they cannot charge DHS more than they would charge a private pay. So, for example, in my zip code, it's a rate area A, and for an infant, that rate is $1,000. I believe it's $1,000. For simplicity, we'll just say infant full-time monthly rate is $1,000. For a certified in-home provider, the provider who receives that could ask a private pay family to pay $1,200 but could not charge private pay families $900 and then charge DHS the full $1,000. But there's some confusion from some providers about that. And then for those who do understand the rule, oftentimes when you ask them, why do you not charge your private pay families more than the DHS rate, you are allowed to do so, they answer very simply, because my families can't afford that. Even if they aren't on subsidy or they don't qualify for subsidy, asking them for $200 more a month than what I get for the DHS rate is just not something that they are able to do. So it's kind of this double-edged sword where they understand that they probably need to, but they're not asking because they know their families can't afford it. So that's certainly one thing that we should be looking at.
So if your infant is in your group A, $941, unless they're in a licensed maximum facility, $1,255.
That's for center, yes.
But if they are, here's my concern. I'll call it a concern. If they are in group C,
right,
which is a huge list of zip codes. I mean, this is all on state
right.
website.
It's 400.
If you are in group C, that license maximum rate is $625 for the same family, if you will. Mm-hmm. It is 50 cents on the dollar. Because of the zip code you live in.
Chair Lively, Representative Hayden, yes, it's true, and it's been a very point of contention for our providers as well. I know that I can't speak to bargaining or current bargaining sessions, but I know that previously that providers have asked for the state to look at this and have offered equitable solutions, but we also are. We also are required to pay I'm trying to remember how the language works. It's recommended level of 75th percentile of the current market rate study. And this is to ensure that we never go below that, because this is one of the areas of the child care development block grants where you're allowed to look at multiple types of studies to get to a rate. But they want to ensure that child care is making at least a certain amount that's fair. And so the providers that are participating in the survey, and I think that they're probably underrepresented and they're probably keeping their wages low in the way that they're responding or the numbers that are responding, and Bobby Weber would be able to speak well to that. It does create an unfair system, but we need to make sure the language that was in House Bill 2015 that ensured the 75th percentile made sure that they would never go below that, so that we weren't, you know, basing bonus rates for the quality rating and improvement system, for example, on the 75th percentile. Because in other states where they don't have that floor of saying we must pay child care providers at least this through subsidy, they've dropped below that significantly, and bonus rates get to the 75th percentile. So while we're still not fair or right, it's,
you know. So let me just reiterate this one more time. Again, these are just right off the state's website. If you're an infant, a family with an infant from Portland, Eugene, Corvallis, Monmouth, or Ashland, your infant, your subsidy for your infant's care is $1,255 in a maximum licensed, $1,255. But if you come from, they don't even list towns, other areas, right, other zip codes across the state, right? These are obviously the group B is Salem, Medford, Roseburg, Brookings, areas outside metropolitan areas of Eugene. This is the second category. And then the third category is, of course, all other, rural Oregon, my district, basically. And you look at those rates, and they say maximum license is $625. So that's about 50%. But the reality is that these kids are being mostly taken care of by the standard rates, right? In those rural areas, more likely to be a standard rate, is $469. So it really brings it down to a 3-to-1. Really brings it down to a 3-to-1 is what we're talking about.
30, 33,
34, 35 cents on the dollar for your families with rural children versus metropolitan area to get the full buck, right? It's 3-to-1.
From Chair Lively, Representative Hayden, we've asked that same question.
Keep asking it.
That's right.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. So I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2985, and this will be carried over to our meeting on the 18th when we'll address the amendment and whatever the fiscal, because we don't have the fiscal yet, and so we'll need at that time to be able to take action on that bill. So let's see if I'm just doing so now. I'm going to open a work session on House Bill 3087. Invite Kate, and I think there was somebody. Is there going to be somebody in revenue or DCBS or who else is here?
Yes.
Or both. Both.
Chair Lively, members of the committee, for the record, Kate Newhall, representing Family Forward Oregon. And I would like to have both DCBS and Department of Revenue up here because they both have technical expertise and some of the questions might be more appropriate for one or the other of them. So my understanding is that the committee was interested in talking through a little bit more the -2 amendments, which you now have in OLIS. And I'm happy to answer questions. I will say when I gave my testimony on the -1 amendments, I tried to note, because at that point we had already submitted the request for the -2s, exactly where the differences between the -1s and the -2s would be. But just to touch on those really quickly again, what I would say the primary difference in the -2s versus the -1s is to make sure that we had given proper authority to DCBS and the Department of Revenue to collect the payroll assessments and to collect payments and enforcement on those. I will say in now reviewing the -2s with both Department of Revenue and DCBS, we do know that there is one small change that needs to happen because what happened in the -2s, I think, was a drafting error and some of the authority that needed to be given to DCBS to enforce premiums was actually given to the Department of Revenue. So in Section 5, there are a couple places where we just need to change the authority from Department of Revenue's authority to DCBS's. But I think that that is an amendment that will be fairly quick and can probably be done when this moves on to the Revenue Committee, if that.
So can you or one of you, So since it's both DCBS and Revenue, I think we just need to clearly understand the role of each, how this intersects. Because if I remember, the DCBS ultimately is the administrator of the program. So if somebody can help us with that.
So Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Deanna Mack with the Department of Revenue. And the way the Department of Revenue gets involved in this is through our quarterly payroll tax return. This is something that it's a combined return between us, Department of the Employment Department, and the Department of Consumer Business Services to collect the withholding tax, the UI tax, unemployment insurance tax, as well as some of the transit taxes and the workers' benefit fund. So we have an agreement with the Employment Department that they will process the return for the payroll taxes, and we bank the money. So we bank the money and distribute that money to our sister agencies. So the vision for this is that the form will be modified or schedule added or something along those lines. On the back end, we will bank the money for DCBS for both the workers' benefit fund as well as the paid family leave and distribute the money to them to split to the workers' benefit fund versus this paid family leave fund. And then they will administer the program from start to finish. They will set up, the benefit program, figure rates, all of that stuff, establish overpayments if there have been overpayments up to the point where there is a bill that someone owes, and at that point in time they will send that debt to the Department of Revenue through our other agency accounts program as a fee-based program. We collect on behalf of many agencies. We even collect currently for DCBS for some of their fines and fees that they charge. So we've tried to incorporate as best we can existing procedures. So that's where the Department of Revenue comes in. We're going to bank the money for them up front, And then at the back end, when they have some debt that they need to have collected for some reason or another, then we'll collect it through our other agency accounts program.
And I assume, is there a standard fee that you charge for across all departments, or how does that work?
Mr. Chair, there is a standard fee. I don't know what it is off the top of my head. It's a percentage of the amount collected. And then if it cannot exceed our actual cost to collect. So if the rate we establish, let's say it's 10%, if it ends up being more than our cost for the year, then we rebate that back to our agencies, our sister agencies, for the work that we do. We currently have agreements with about 180 state agencies that we do that with.
Chair Lively, sure. Members of the committee, for the record, Teresa Van Winkle, Department of Consumer and Business Services. So yes, to follow up on Deanna's testimony. Yeah, so DCBS is responsible for the general program administration of this. And also to touch on the existing quarterly payroll collections. One of the things that we're working with employment is capturing the data for the workers, the wages and such, to base the claims off of for the verification process. DCBS is also responsible for in the collections that are being processed for the employer and employee to do reconciliation. This will be parallel to what we currently do for our workers' compensation assessments, which includes, if there are overpayments from the employer, it includes refunds as well. So it's not just in collections. It's actually if they overpay, we do provide that. Or if it is attributed to a different department, for example, if it's they mis-entered information that should have been for unemployment insurance, it would go to the right department. We would also be responsible for the general claims processing of the program. Also, a dispute resolution process for both employees and employers for various aspects, which is in development. Also in fraud prevention and recoveries as need be. And then also, because this is taxable, the benefits are taxable, we also are responsible for providing the tax documents to individuals.
Okay. Other questions? So, Kate, was there changes in the Dash 2 as relates to the amount of maximum benefit that people could obtain?
Yes, there was a change to the benefit cap. We had in the Dash 1 set a benefit cap of $1,200 a week. DCBS helpfully pointed out that by the time the program comes online in 2021, that the average weekly wage will probably be close to about $1,100 a week. So instead of that, we tied it to the cap to a percentage of average weekly wage, and the equivalent percentage would be 130%.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you. Representative Pack.
Thank you, Chair. I don't really have a question. I just have a pretty large concern I'm going to throw out. The initial memorandum from DCBS has the reasonable range for a one-year benefit cost estimate at $748 million to $1.12 billion. So I'm just going to throw that out there.
Wait, I'm sorry. That's not
and, right. Of course, I won't mention another bill number because we're not going to get into that, but the other one
thank you.
Doesn't have a fiscal. So not that I'm bitter by any means, but just saying.
Anybody else have? Representative Bynum, please.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Mm-hmm. I wanted to see if there was any opportunity to get to my question on, maybe the priority of repaying overpayments for unemployment insurance. I had asked the question the last time, and I got a very simple response, which I think was a misunderstanding about one simple overpayment of $44 million. But were you able to go back and check and see what the overpayment balance is to the state for the unemployment insurance account? And how do we not run an overpayment in this system?
Mr. Chair and Representative Bynum, I think that question had been directed to the Department of Revenue, but I believe that was a question for the Employment Department, and I don't know if they have followed up on that or not. I apologize if there was a miscommunication on our part. The Employment Department has federal fund matching, and they have to do their own collections for and their own administration of that fund. I don't have a specific answer. I don't know if they're in the audience or not, or are listening.
I don't see anybody jumping up. So.
Yeah, I apologize.
Chair Lively, Representative Bynum, I will take responsibility for just following up with the Employment Department because I don't have that information, but I will. We have been working with them through this, and I will let them know that this question has come up so that we can get you that information.
As to say, Chair Lively, Representative Bynum, also to follow up, so after the work session when you answer the question, one of the things that my team that's working on the fiscal development is looking at is potential ways of reducing the level of overpayments and process that we would have to do. And so we're looking at different methodologies for that to try and limit as much as we can.
Is that for the UI program, or is it for this particular
Chair
program?
Chair Lively, and this will be specific to the family program.
Okay.
Sure, no, go ahead.
I just think from a fiscal responsibility standpoint, we need to shore up all of our accounts. And I, as an employer, what I see, I think it's good that people, as soon as they're in need, that they have payments processed as quickly as possible, because losing your job is a traumatic event. But I also know how people file unemployment claims, and a lot of them, the ones that I deal with, are people who have walked away and don't legitimately have a fair claim. And so you end up in this overpayment situation. And every dollar in this state matters. And so I want to make sure that any system that we set up is done in a fiscally responsible way, and that there's not millions of dollars sitting out there on a balance sheet that we can't recover. So that's my thing.
So in this program, given the amount of money involved, you're concerned about what that balance would be versus what the payouts need to be and how much of that money is there. And I think, again, if I correct me, Kate, if I'm wrong, but so DCBS has the ability to change the rate based on meeting the requirements of the funding. So in theory, if it builds up more than expected in that, they could reduce the rate.
Chair Lively, that's correct. DCBS has the flexibility to adjust the rate within sidebar, so they can't adjust it above the 0.5% of payroll for both employers and employees. Yeah. And I think what their cost analysis has shown is that what they're expecting, the middle range, is that it is going to be about 0.4% each to the employer and the employee. But I will say, to sort of Representative Hack's point, that I think DCBS did want to make sure and give sort of that wide range, so that when they did their assessments, they based it on what California's program and experience has been. But if for whatever reason our experience is different, we wanted to make sure that we were still within that range and not going over that 1% of payroll. So if anything, I expect that percentage would be adjusted downwards in future years with our own experiences.
Representative Brocksmith.
I appreciate Representative Bynum bringing up the unemployment conversation, because as a former employer, when we or the business community has to contribute, if we miss our contribution, they're sure there to get it. My question is, with a $748 million to $1.2 billion annual fiscal, where do you suggest those dollars come from?
Chair Lively, Representative Brocksmith, I think that our intent in designing this program is that we were designing an insurance benefit that was self-sustaining and wasn't relying in any way, shape, or form on general fund support from the state for administering the benefit. So it is that 0.5% payroll assessment that will be what funds the program.
Follow up.
Oh, sure, go ahead.
No, where are the public dollars going to come from with regards to teachers, counties, cities, all the public employers across the state?
Mm-hmm.
Where are those dollars going to come
from? General
fund.
So, Chair Lively, Representative Brocksmith, I think that is a place the state is an employer, and it will have that 0.5% payroll contribution too. And I think actually, when looking at it, it seems to me like a very reasonable cost for the state in terms of the economic benefit and benefit to families. But certainly that will be, I think, a part of the conversation as we have going forward. I misunderstood your question. I apologize about that.
No problem. I would humbly disagree, because I'm going to have to lay off teachers in a school district that's already the eighth most impoverished in the nation. So I disagree. Thank you.
Representative Page.
Thank you, Chair.
You're welcome.
So, to follow up on that, clearly there would be a significant cost, in my opinion, to the funds that the state has to provide through taxpayers to cover the public employees with this, because we pay that portion. And you say the return on those dollars is worth the dollars spent. Is it still worth it at the cost of taking health insurance away, for example, from the low-income people so they don't even have the insurance to have the baby? I mean, at what point is that return on investment worth it?
Chair Lively, Representative Hayden, I think when I talk about return on investment, I talk about a lot of the same things that I just talked about in my testimony on child care. I think the more that parents, working Oregonians, can stay in the workforce and not take big gaps in their careers because of caregiving needs, I think that does overall benefit the full economy. And I hope we are not being faced with, you know, pitting these things against each other. I guess I would argue that we need both of them.
We'll follow up. Well, isn't a budget kind of by definition pitting things against? You've got X amount of dollars, you got to decide where that's going to get. How can that not be pitting things against each other? I mean, that's a budget, right?
Representative Hernandez, do you have something you'd like to add to this conversation?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Igor Hernandez, a state representative for House 47, East Portland. I'm going to try to respond to some of these questions as well, if you don't mind, Mr. Chair. Just to get to your question first, Representative Brock Smith, as a school board member, I believe that we were long overdue in providing paid and medical leave to our teachers, not just our teachers, but all of our employees. As a state, to get to your question, as a state and as a country, we should have had paid and medical leave, paid family and medical leave a long time ago. We're the only developed nation that doesn't have it. And that causes a lot of consequences down the road when it comes to what our social service sectors provide, whether that's mental health support services for those children that didn't get the right type of development when they were growing up, or emotional cognitive support by their parents in those critical years of development. So that's my perspective on those questions. And, you know, we can talk about revenue issues in terms of why we don't have the amount of revenue to fully meet the needs of the state of Oregon, but I feel like that's a different conversation. This, we're talking about a policy in which we could right now pass to provide Oregonians the opportunity to have paid medical and family leave.
Go ahead, Representative Brock Smith.
Thank you.
I could tell you probably weren't totally green. So.
Pardon me?
I said I could tell you weren't totally green.
So. No, Representative Hernandez, you and I believe, completely agree on the policy behind the leave. But unfortunately, we're in a state that's $1.6 billion in debt, in essence, to fulfill its obligations, and we can't even fulfill the obligations that were voted on by the voters of the state overwhelmingly. And so then try to enact policy, although we might agree that it is good policy to have paid family leave, I want to be able to fulfill the will of the voters before I start enacting policy that will take that will away. And I'll bring it up. There was a bill in this committee that allowed for the ability to have that policy move forward. Unfortunately, that bill did not move forward. And we could have worked on the good policy that I had a conversation about, but we didn't have the opportunity to do so. At no fault of the of anyone here, and that is what's unfortunate. And so again, I agree with the policy behind in everything you said, except for the fact that it needs to be funded first, because I believe this, the will of the voters in bringing forward the various measures should be funded well before we start instituting policy that we don't have the dollars to back.
Chair Lively, Representative Brock-Smith, this is both an employee and employer contribution in payroll. How budgets get determined, that's up to the local school boards and the different government agencies. But this won't have a general fund fiscal, this policy. Although I can see how school districts and other public entities have to meet this policy. That's up to their budgets, budget hearings and budget decision makings, which are different governing bodies for them to do.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Sure.
Thank you. It will have a general fund fiscal because there are state employees that are involved that will have to be funded out of this program. And so that will increase the general fund obligation. And as far as the as a former county commissioner, as a former city councilor, as a current school board member, my communities in my district in Southwest Oregon are barely hanging on. My county in Josephine just laid off 70 deputies because they will no longer have the ability, those citizens in Josephine County, after May 31st to call 911. To call 911 and have a sheriff's deputy respond. And so I am sorry when I'm looking at the safety and welfare of our citizens over implementing a policy that, again, might be good policy. And we had an opportunity to look at the ability to move good policy, but the fiscal is just far too great.
Yeah, Chair Lively, Representative Brock-Smith, you're absolutely right that our local governments are struggling to fully fund the resources needed. This may be a larger conversation on what the root causes of our issues are, whether they're ballot measures 550 that restrict counties and cities from collecting the revenue they need to do their job, or whether it's business tax reform. These are larger structural problems that need to be addressed, and I hope we address them this session. In this committee, and currently right now, we're listening to this policy, and it's a good policy. And not only that, but I believe this is a preventative measure for us to save money on the long run. In supporting families and making sure that they have the best opportunity to thrive. And in the long run, it will be beneficial to the state to have more folks be healthier.
So, colleagues, we will have lots more opportunities to debate not just this bill, but their very issues. And they're absolutely valid, the concerns you're raising. I don't say they're not, Representative Brock-Smith. I
appreciate that.
And we will. And whether it be the conversation around this or it be a conversation about our state budget, that is going to, even before we get to this, we're going to have to address. And so they are valid. This particular case, this bill will next go to revenue if we move it from here. There will be lots of opportunities, the discussions and things at revenue. After that point, it would go to Ways and Means, in which there would be more conversations than that. And obviously, if it ends up Ways and Means in the current environment we're in, even if there's the tax for that portion of it, and that has impacts on other things you talked about, so there'll be more opportunities and conversations. So those are all very valid conversations to have, but the committee isn't going to be able to resolve those. But I appreciate your questions in bringing up the other impacts, because that certainly is, those are real questions that we got to struggle with.
Appreciate the ability to have the discussion with the representative from Northeast Portland.
Can I ask you a question?
Okay.
Chair Lively, in your vast experience and wisdom, would this if this was enacted and went through all the processes you just laid out, and it was a requirement that our counties had to comply with, would that be considered an unfunded mandate?
Yes, it would.
Interesting. I think to an extent it would, because they have, right, it would be considered. We would tell them they have to do it, but a lot of policies we do at the state couldn't fit back into that category. The good news about this particular recommendation, it brings with it an identified funding stream, but I'm not arguing with what you're saying, how it might be viewed, especially at the counties and that. Okay. It would be another one of those policies. Representative Bynum.
I'd just like to make an observation, and I think it just points to basically how we come to our religion and our religion of our politics. And I think in some cases, for me as a business owner, the policy and the funding mechanism go hand in hand. They can't be separated for me. Mm-hmm. And I think other people can easily separate them. And I think that's sometimes how our conversations get a little bit they get a little bit more tense. It's just how we separate them out. So I think this is a really robust conversation, but I think it's helpful to know how each of us comes seeing things. So
very good point. Thank you. That's absolutely correct. That does add to it. So I think I'm going to close the work session. And so this bill will be carried over until Tuesday. That's the final day in which we can take any actions on bills. So just as a reminder, so we have House Bill 2985 carried over Tuesday, when we'll consider the amendment and the fiscal on it. We have House Bill 3068, which is a cleanup bill from early learning, which we're doing one more minor amendment on, and then House Bill 3087, so the bills from today that we're carrying over. But so Tuesday will be the final day we can either move or not move things. I appreciate fellow legislatures, your patience, and I appreciate the discussions.
Oh, me too.
Because absolutely, we need to have the discussion. Yeah, but I appreciate what you just said about how we look at it and where we come is part of the hard part of the discussion.
Very true.
Because we come from different directions. Mm-hmm. And compliments to your son, who did very well out there in a very boring meeting.
Is he alive?
He evidently.
Oh, look at that.
He's alive, Mom.
He is. He's just fine.
I'm going to turn the meeting.
We all get in trouble.
I'm going to turn the meeting.
Yep.